Now for agribusiness news, markets, and weather from Studio C, this is Agriculture Today.
U.S. pork production continues to inch upward this year, hog prices inching downward. USDA analysts say that trend will likely continue next year. USDA Outlook Board Chairman Mark Jackanowski told us so far this year, hog prices have weakened more than expected.
So we reduced our 2022 price forecast by $2.50 per hundredweight. They're currently forecast at $71.28 per hundredweight. Didn't make any changes to our 2023 price forecast, but year over year, hog prices are currently forecast to be down $1.53 per hundredweight.
About a 2% drop from this year, with USDA forecasting 2023 pork output to climb by about 1.5% from this year at 27.5 billion pounds. Gary Crawford, Washington.
This is Agriculture Today.
My name is Rick Clark. I'm a fifth-generation farmer from West Central Indiana, and we farm about 7,000 acres of row crops.
Clark testified last week before the House Ag Committee.
Folks, this is urgent and it's critical that we have bipartisan action on the topic at hand today. I am a Republican, and I've spoken to thousands of farmers across this country, and not once has my party affiliation come up. The witnesses here today do not represent the diversity of regenerative farmers and ranchers. We are especially missing voices of indigenous leaders and farmers of color. And it is critical in this farming journey that you have the support of your family. And I'm going to tell you, they have my back. American farmers are the most productive in the world, but we have to acknowledge the condition our soils are in. We are in trouble. 5.6 tons per acre per year of soil are leaving our fields. I'm not here today to offend the practices of any farmer, and we have to understand the heritage and history they have. We also need to understand our soil is fragile and degrading right in front of our eyes, which leads me to why I'm here today. Adopting soil health practices can slow down and reverse the degradation of soil. I want to leave you today with the confidence that regenerative agriculture can be incorporated into any farming operation and be far better for your bottom line. After decades of heavy tillage on our farm, a one-inch rain event created so much erosion on our farm, I knew it was time to do something different. Like thousands of farmers, I started cover cropping through EQIP. This is an essential program to increase farmers' comfort level of change. In my written testimony, there is a photo of my soil and my neighbor's soil just 20 feet apart from each other. The difference is astounding. My soils have water infiltration rates of 20 inches per hour, and the neighbors have an infiltration rate of 0.5 inch of rain per hour. Our soils have 1.5 million earthworms per acre. The neighbors' farms have nearly zero earthworms. So, how do we get there? We need to follow the six principles of soil health. One, context. This is key. While practices change from Texas to Indiana, principles are universal. Two, minimize disturbance. Three, maximize diversity. Four, living roots. Five, armor the soil. Six, animal integration. A little bit more about our operation. We have not used starter fertilizer, seed treatments, fungicides, insecticides, pesticides, phosphorus, or potassium in 8 years. And to boot, we're organic with no tillage. I am far down this path, but any farm can start and experience incredible results with ecologically and economically, especially with proper education and support. And note, it doesn't have to be organic. Cover crops are doing more than protecting and building soil. Our operation, cover crops, have become an offensive juggernaut, with cereal rye giving us upwards of $435 per acre worth of NP&K, and legume cover crops giving us upwards of $969 worth of value when terminated with a roller crimper at maturity. Most farmers can't achieve this without tools, education, and changes to crop insurance rules that require termination well before maturity. On our farm, we have currently reduced diesel fuel consumption by 50%, chemistry and fertility by 100%, and based on regional input spending averages, we are saving $1,957,000 annually.
It's Agriculture Today.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
Right Repair is very near and dear to my heart.
Kay Gordon Byrne is Executive Director of the Digital Right to Repair Coalition.
And it's particularly near and dear to me because I do live in an underserved rural area of upstate New York. And having been a technology person for most of my career, I hope that I can speak well to this. If we can't fix our stuff, and I mean it in a very general sense, because anything that has a chip in it right now I call stuff. So I don't have to mention any manufacturers. But if we can't fix our stuff, we are in the position of we got to throw it away, buy new, or do without. Throwing away is why we have an e-waste problem. Most of our states and municipalities are not beginning to collect the full extent of what is now e-waste. And that winds up being a taxpayer expense. If we're buying new, that's also a very limited problem, a limiting factor for people, particularly people that are already on public assistance of some kind, which last I saw is about 50% of the population. So it's a big problem for people that are not wealthy. And then going without is why we have a digital divide. So I think it's a very serious problem. It's not a trivial problem. It affects everything that we buy. And when I was preparing for testimony at the Federal Trade Commission, I looked at manufacturer policies and pretty much concluded, as did U.S. PIRG, that about 90% of the products on the market today are already repair monopolized, meaning that the only option for repair, if there is one, is through the manufacturer. So this eliminates all competition. These have now starting to be recognized in the courts as actual monopolies. And there's some discussion among the state's attorneys general, et cetera, of how they might approach these monopolies and try to untangle them. Obviously, rural people, such as myself and a number of the members here, we're already underserved. Just because everything is far away. We don't have much access to medical care. Education is distant. High-speed internet is still a problem. And even getting groceries. I mean, I'm 15 miles from a grocery store. I have to plan ahead. If something breaks in my house, I really do have to fix it because the nearest technician could be 45 or 100 miles away. So I live in a community where repair is kind of in our DNA, and we need to be able to do it. And that's not just consumers. That's also all the businesses in town. They face the same problems. And they need the same options to be able to fix their stuff. Now, urban areas, which I know has been a question, how is it that urban areas are underserved? Well, they're really underserved if they don't have money, which is not the same as distance, although they may have also, let's say, public transit might not go to the mall where there's a local store. So it's even harder for people in underserved urban communities to get access to what I would call price competitive repair. And most of those people simply do without. So in order to turn this ship around, we really do have to make repairs more widely accessible and less. It's not even so much money as it is availability. Farmers in particular always tell us that they don't mind paying. They just have to have their stuff fixed. So the key to keeping all of this working is to have the option of competition for repair, which we've discovered works pretty well using a legislative template that the auto industry began with. They passed their first bill in Massachusetts in 2012. It rapidly led to an industry, an agreement that's now a national agreement. It's not perfect, but it's working. And we copied it. I literally sat down and wrote the first bill by taking out the word automobile and stuffing in the word digital electronic product. And the philosophy is the same. A state can say, Mr. Manufacturer, if you're going to do business in my state, you must provide fair and reasonable access to the same parts, tools, diagnostics, and service information that you are currently only providing on an exclusive basis to your dealership.
It's Agriculture Today.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
Having that new classing office here is just, it's incredible for the High Plains cotton industry.
Kevin Brinkley is president and CEO of PCCA, Plains Cotton Cooperative Association, on a new USDA cotton classing office in Lubbock.
You go back decades, HVI, high volume instrument classing, was invented right out here in West Texas, and it's paid big dividends for the industry. It's gotten our cotton more visible on the global stage for all the years that we've been using that type classification. And so, the classing complex, as it's now called here in Lubbock, is totally automated. And so what that means is when The gin furnishes a sample to the classing office. It's got a little barcode on it. That barcode gets scanned by the classing office, and as soon as they run it through their automated processes, it's mostly hands-off at this point, which brings speed, efficiency, accuracy, repeatability, all the things that a grower wants. Then that data that describes that cotton is put into the AMS database. And companies like ours, we automatically pull that class out of that database and furnish it to the farmer, and that way it can make its way into the marketing chain. And so, you know, when you think about an office that can easily class 5 million bales a year, just in this Lubbock office, this newly launched facility, man, you know, we just looking forward to the day when we can put 5 million bales through it. And so it's an incredible accomplishment to think of the partnership between USDA and Texas Tech and the industry leadership here in the Lubbock area that put that together. Just a real showcase for the U.S. cotton industry. And I suspect that that one facility will probably draw a lot of international customers of Texas cotton here just to see that. And, of course, you know, all the other things that we can show them while they're here.
To appreciate the new classing office, Brinkley says it's important to understand what classing an individual bale ID really means.
Well, it's what the industry lives and dies on. So textile mills are looking for very precise descriptions of a bale of cotton so that they can blend that cotton properly each time they get an order for a certain type of yarn that makes, you know, an application like a dress shirt or bed sheets or whatever it is. They have specifications in terms of the strength of that yarn and the fineness of it. And so they use a lot of technology to make those selections. And so they have to have precise measurements of what that bale represents. And so if you have bales in a lay down in a textile mill, each one's going to have a specific position, and then an automated arm is going to come pick up a chunk of that cotton and go deposit it into the blending process where it makes its way into yarn. So every mill in the world is looking to know exactly what they're buying, and so it's critical that we do that accurately and can do it with a high degree of quality.
Kevin Brinkley, President and CEO of Plains Cotton Cooperative Association. It's Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
Having grown up on a farm in the 40s and 50s, and then moving to Georgia, in both states I've seen the rural communities go from vital centers and economic centers to places that are many times ghost towns, with many people having to change careers.
Steve Nygren is founder, CEO of Serenity in Georgia, testifying before the House Ag Committee on regenerative ag.
I have 18 first cousins. They have all left the industry except for three, and they are larger farmers today. The idea of our food system is not only going to affect what we eat, but the very economic fiber of this country. And I think some of the things that you see that have happened in rural America is an example of the changing systems that we've had. As you've heard today, there are solutions that will both give us better food and an economic foundation for our rural areas. And the Farm Bill can really change that.
He says modern ag is basically the enemy. But Doug LaMalfa is a representative from California and a rice farmer.
Mr. Moyer, you mentioned in the testimony that America's food system is broken and that conventional ag models are degrading farmland. Now, way back in the 30s in the Dust Bowl, even before that, but the federal government set on a path to try and do things to conserve soil because we saw some terrible outcomes from weather and such affecting the soil. So much work has been done over the years before this concept of doing things to conserve soil, not lose it to erosion, things of that nature. So we've seen tremendous gains made in crop yield and, you know, less labor being required for agriculture in this country. It used to be 50%. Now it's less than 1% of people work in agriculture these days, it seems. So labor's declined, land use has declined in order to get increased crop yields. So one thing I found in strong agreement with you on is a reliance on international food supply is really going to be dangerous for all of us. We see Russia's invasion of Ukraine. The world's going to be in a bad way with that. India and Hungary have decided they're not going to support grain this year. And so we're going to have a real 2023 food supply issue. So as well as the gas and fertilizer needs that we have to produce fertilizer, natural gas. So Sri Lanka has tried to go against using fertilizer and such, and their economy's collapsing. The Netherlands, the Dutch dairy farmers are an all-out protest over that, and we see Canada, our friendly neighbors in the north, go in that direction too. But the Netherlands will close 11,000 farms and affect over 17,000 farmers. So if our government were to enact similar measures, getting rid of nitrogen and all these things, it would have a catastrophic effect on the U.S. food supply and also the world. So the suggestion to reapproach farming as regenerative organic seems to be counterintuitive to part of the testimony. So how is it when we have a global food shortage that when we're talking about these alternative forms of farming and we're going to have end up with less food, less crop grown, or we're converting to cover crops, or we're going to have lower yield with regenerative organic, as you term it, how is that going to work in a world that's already going to see perilous food shortages, as even promised by President Biden?
It's Agriculture Today.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
AED is the International Trade Association representing independent companies that sell, rent, and service equipment used in many applications, including construction, agriculture, forestry, energy, mining, material handling, and industrial production.
Ken Taylor is president of the Ohio Machinery Corporation, testifying recently before the House Small Business Committee.
Ohio Machinery Company was founded in 1945, and I'm the third generation for my family to run the business, following both my father and my grandfather. Right to repair is a simple slogan. However, the policy proposals surrounding the issue are complex with significant consequences. At the outset, I want to make it clear. AED members support customers' right to repair their machinery, and distributors make available diagnostic tools, repair information, parts, and remote customer support. Idle, non-functioning equipment equals lost time and money. Whether it's on a farm during harvest or on a road building project, there's absolutely zero incentive to not do everything we can as equipment dealers and manufacturers to keep a machine running. That can mean repairs completed by a dealership service technician, the customer, or a third-party provider. The equipment industry is highly competitive. And if Ohio Machinery Company isn't providing proper and timely service, nothing is stopping the customer from moving to one of my many competitors and their products. However, we don't support unfettered access to critical onboard software and information pertaining to environmental and safety protections or key operational functions, which is what proposals in various states and Congress would do. The tractors we're selling today are not the same as those sold by my grandfather or even my father. While customers can complete most repairs to their machinery, government environmental and safety regulations, as well as technological developments that have made equipment more efficient and productive, necessitate restrictions in access to source code and software that ensure key operational functions aren't modified or disabled. Right to repair legislation currently being considered in Congress will completely alter the equipment industry's distribution model. Manufacturers of equipment rely on a network of independent, mostly family-owned, small to medium-sized companies to sell, rent, and service the equipment. These dealers make significant investments in their employees, including training service technicians to repair and maintain the latest high-technology machinery. Many AED members' facilities are located in rural and underserved areas, creating well-paying careers and economic opportunity. Equipment dealers also invest extensive capital in parts inventories to ensure repairs and maintenance can occur as soon as possible. Out of service equipment isn't merely an inconvenience. It can ruin a farmer's harvest or delay completion of a bridge or roadway. However, right to repair proposals require original equipment manufacturers to sell parts and diagnostic tools directly to the public at cost, without profit, completely circumventing the equipment dealer. Aside from effectively dismantling the equipment distribution industry's aftermarket parts business and thereby putting many equipment dealers out of business, logistically it is impractical and would only exacerbate inflationary pressures in the equipment market and create long delays in parts availability.
It's Agriculture Today.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
No, it is. It's a tough year. I mean, right now we're projected to have the lowest national yield that we've had almost since hybridization. Just tells you how rough it is how big a geographic area.
Tim Lust is president and CEO of the National Sorghum Producers on the 2022 crop.
As resilient as sorghum is, it still takes water, still takes a little bit of water. And so it's a tough year, we'll thrive and do the best we can and hold on, and we have. In a lot of areas, farmers are going to harvest a crop. It's just not going to be the yields that we're used to, certainly, from a sorghum industry standpoint. So, I think this is a crop that a lot of growers certainly this part of the United States on all commodities are going to be looking forward to having behind them and looking towards a brighter 2023, hopefully.
With the short supply expected for 2022, how does this set the table for 2023?
I was just talking to one of our big marketers last week, and our entire crop size this year may be less than what we exported last year. So that just gives you an idea that, we're going to have a lot of demand and a shortage of product. So I do expect we've continued to see basis increase just weekly here as we've going into harvest, and certainly believe we're going to have some very good prices and some very good market opportunities.
But as challenging as the year has been for sorghum producers, it's been equally challenging for cotton producers. Kevin Brinkley is president and CEO of Lubbock-based Plains Cotton Cooperative Association.
As most people listening probably are aware, it's not good. This has probably been, in my years of watching this, over 30 now, this has been the toughest year ever as far as production. So, you could take a drive around any parts of really, if you just wanted to start in South Texas, you had a decent crop in the valley. But once you drive north of there, they were really under the same drought stresses. Not quite as severe, but for them, a serious matter. They were in the same drought stresses down there, and it's really knocked back their production. And even on the fields where they didn't fail, they still, their yields are greatly diminished. So if you just drove north and went up to the rolling plains, high plains, Oklahoma, Kansas, Kansas is probably going to outproduce Oklahoma this year. Not a very likely scenario in most years, but they did catch some early rains up there that kind of helped them get off to a better start. But they've been dry since August, and that crop has also gone backwards on us. So, we've got USDA put out an estimate, just a few days ago that showed the Texas crop at 3.2. I think that's probably a little bit optimistic, and probably, the 250,000 bales they've got for Oklahoma is too optimistic as well. So I hate to report such bad news, but that's kind of the cards that we've been dealt this year, and we just have to make the best of it and hope for some more favorable weather next season.
Kevin Brinkley with PCCA. It's Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
Meat consumers next year will likely have a little smaller supply of meat to choose from as U.S. production is forecast lower next year.
The main reduction year over year in terms of meat supplies is coming from beef.
In fact, USDA Outlook Chairman Mark Jekanowski says it's all due to an expected reduction of almost 1.7 billion pounds of beef output next year, mostly caused by what's happening this year with cattle producers facing a lot of challenges.
Drought in the West and high feed costs, lack of availability of hay and high cost of production.
And so many cattle producers are sending more animals than normal to slaughter, sending them sooner than normal because they can't afford to feed them. This is leading to more beef output this year, but
fewer supplies in the future because you're slaughtering more of the herd in the near term.
Mark says this will likely send average steer prices up again next year by about 7.5%. Gary Crawford, Washington.